Matt, let's get started with the conflict in the Middle East right now. In your opinion, how fragile and how important is this new escalation in the Middle East?
You know, I think we're not being exaggerative when we say maybe this is how people felt 110 years ago, you know, in August 1914, sitting on a precipice like this, staring into the potential that could be for a regional war that would be would dwarf what's occurring in Ukraine, you know, in the sense of just how massive this thing would be, as well as to the vortex it would create to pull in all sorts of other nations. You know, sitting here as we watch this, I have in the back of my mind this idea of am I witnessing, you know, one of the grand historical events, not just of our history, but of our modern human history. Is it about to unfold? Or hopefully, and this is the best case, and I think what we're all clinging to, that this will just be the next tit for tat, that what we'll see happen is what we saw happen in April, just on an expanded level, that the Iranian attacks that may be combined, likely combined with Hezbollah and the Yemenis, as well as, of course, Hamas and PIJ and others chipping what they can into it, will be just a larger version of what we saw back in April. So I can't imagine the Iranians are going to give the Israelis 3 days head notice like they did back in April, that the launching of the drones that will take 7 hours to reach Israel will be televised. I don't think we're going to see any of that. And, you know, it probably be a couple days, 2-3 days of attacks, but then hopefully that will be it. And that is what the Iranians are saying. Their statements are that they want to reestablish stability. They want to reestablish deterrence. And so it's a tit for tat. And hopefully the Israelis keep it at that. But certainly the way things have lined up, the way other nations have leaned forward into this, the expectation of what may occur that would then prompt preemptive responses. Again, it's reminiscent of 110 years ago. Not exactly the same, of course, but it's reminiscent of it. And the historicity of that, the magnitude of that, is something I think that parallel is something that we really have to acknowledge it and kind of be humble in the moment, right? Of like, my God, we may be witnessing, we may be about to witness something that generations upon generations from now will still refer to.
Can we say that Netanyahu is not happy with the current situation?
I don't know. I don't know. He certainly is still in power. He certainly is not on trial for corruption charges. He's certainly not in prison. He has, although a lot of people out in the streets against him, not nearly the number of people out in the streets against him as, say, a year ago, when you have, what, hundreds of thousands, maybe a million Israelis out in the streets protesting that he should be in the dock, that he should be on trial and going to jail. You know, so talking maybe a million out of, what, eight million Israeli Jews protesting against Netanyahu. So he has to be happy that that's not the circumstance. Things are lining up. He's getting potentially the war for greater Israel that he has wanted, I think, for a very long time. I think understanding his personal background, his own personal history, is somewhat important. You know, he is a man who grows up a lot in the United States, and doesn't seem to have been interested in Israel in the way you would have expected for the man who he became. And then his brother is killed. His brother was a commando with the Israeli army, and his brother is killed. And that's what pushes Netanyahu. This is the popular telling. This is what pushes Netanyahu into the Israeli army and becoming an Israeli nationalist himself, becoming the head figure of that Likud security sect. You know, so is all of this coming to a point for him where he has a chance to be vindicated in everything he has done to validate and to honor his brother's loss? You know, I mean, am I getting too far into his head thinking that? But you look at, like, in the sense of the way things have lined up for this regional war, not just in the sense of having your enemies arrayed against you, So having Israel's enemies prepared to attack in a coordinated fashion, whether it was done by accident or whether this was some type of 4D, four-dimensional chess or whatever, the ability to have it so that there is a very real reason for Hezbollah, Iran, the Yemenis, the popular mobilization forces in Iraq and Syria, as in, of course, the Palestinians, and with the Turks saying all kinds of things as well, with Iran having the support of Russia at this point, with the Arab nations largely quiet. They've got their American bases there, but they've all been largely quiet about this, too quiet for many of the Arab populations which they lord over. You know, that all alignment is set to allow for this type of war in a way that we haven't seen in my lifetime. I was born in 1973, right? So maybe I was a couple months old the last time we saw this type of alignment. And then on the other side, you have the alignment with the United States. The fact that Benjamin Netanyahu was just here. He got the American Congress to kneel and kiss his ring. He maybe did not get explicit support for a war like we're discussing, but he certainly didn't have anyone in D.C. telling him not to do it. And what he's only received since then is affirmation that the Americans will stand with him. And for someone like Netanyahu, for the powers to be in Israel, for those who believe in greater Israel, that's all that's needed is just the Americans to stand with us in this historical battle, in this battle of time and eras of a cosmic nation, of a cosmic nature, I should say, right? This idea that it's Israel against everyone, well, that's the way it's supposed to be. So you put all that together and you could see how you have that type of mania, that type of madness that is present that allows for a war like we are talking about to not just have been put into place, but to mature into reality. And again, the parallels back to 110 years ago, not perfect, not exact by any means, but, you know, but that's what Mark Twain said. He didn't say that, you know, history rhymes. Doesn't repeat itself, it rhymes. And this certainly does rhyme.
It seems that Netanyahu is getting everything that he wanted to have. Iran and United States.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, everybody is distracted from what's going on in Gaza.
Right.
And it's unbelievable, Matt, what's going on. In the United States, everybody's just thinking of 2024 and nobody seems to care what's going on.
I mean, the genocide, not just the mass slaughter, of scores of people every day, many of them children. I mean, Israel destroyed a school yesterday, killed at least 30 people, most of them children. And it's commonplace now. It's normalized. I don't even know if it was made any reference in the major American corporate media, because it is so commonplace. Normally, in this world, even with our corrupt corporate media, you know, that is part of the American empire, even with that, they would take note of an attack on a school that killed 30 people, the majority of them children. I don't know if it even made the major American corporate media or not. And it has become just such a normalized thing. Again, not just the slaughter, Nima, but the destruction. All those really critical, important things that go along with the genocide, the ethnic cleansing, so the destruction of the infrastructure, making Gaza uninhabitable, destroying the homes, destroying the healthcare system, destroying the education system, destroying the monuments, the churches, the mosques, the universities, the poets, the actors, everything that a society needs to actually fully exist. The Israelis are systemically destroying it. Maybe the best case in point are the journalists, their deliberate destruction of the journalism of the journalists in Israel as a class, their deliberate targeting of those people because of who they are. More than 150 Palestinian journalists killed since October 7th, you know, deliberately, systematically, again, part of a genocidal campaign, because if you silence those who are telling the story, then did the story ever actually occur?
And the problem right now, Matt, is the people in the Middle East, in Iran, in Saudi Arabia, in all the public opinion in the Middle East is just so desperate. They don't know how to deal with Israel because of this unconditional support coming from the United States.
Yeah, and I mean, I think we've probably talked about this before. This is where the idea of nuclear proliferation gets very, very serious. Well, the Pakistanis have said they will give the Turks a nuclear weapon. If you're Erdogan, if you're the Turkish security establishment, Turkish political class, the Turkish people, and you see what's going on in Gaza, and you cannot help, you cannot send your F-16s south to stop the slaughter because you can't risk losing Ankara to a nuclear attack. All of a sudden, having a nuclear weapon makes a lot of sense. If that's the only thing, along with the United States, two things that are Israel's safeguards here, their nuclear weapons and the United States, well, if you can get your own nuclear weapons, you take that off the table. And the fact that the Americans are a declining empire, an empire that is overextended, that's bankrupt, that's exhausted, that's inept, incompetent, so forth, well, there's a lot of other players who are coming up that you may find yourselves allied with who are a better choice for you than the American empire. I'm talking, of course, about BRICS, talking, of course, about Russia, China, other nations. I can't imagine we're not going to see one of the things that could come out of this would be a renewed strengthened Arab League or Middle Eastern League or something that goes back to the ideas of Arab nationalism or some type of Middle Eastern Middle Eastern partnership. Based upon those things, what can come from this, where we're at, what we're seeing, the Arab nations, as opposed to the Turks, their rulers, are walking, I think, a tightrope. They are, divided between their fealty to the American empire, primarily expressed through the hosting of American bases throughout their country, talking about Jordan, talking about Saudi Arabia, talking about UAE, Qatar, Bahrain, so far, even Oman has a number of American bases there and very critical for American military infrastructure in the region. And at the same time, too, they have a population that sees what's occurring here and they have to balance that. So it is where this goes, not just in these moments, as we're talking, it is 4:15 here on the East Coast in the U.S. So it's as far as I can do the math, it's dark, in the Middle East now, and it very well could be an attack underway or it may come weeks from now. But aside from the acute actions that may be occurring at any moment or soon, you also have these larger ideas of how is this going to change things? How is this fundamentally going to alter the balance of power in the Middle East? Or how is this going to change relationships? And how is this going to begin to write history going forward? And maybe what we're talking about here, this war we're seeing that has been ongoing in Palestine, in the Red Sea, through battles in Iraq and Iran, Lebanon. Maybe this is the precursor to something that comes a few years from now, because the table has not been set yet for what we'll eventually see. The problem is that where's the de-escalation? Some things I think are put in motion, the inertia of which can't be undone, such as the decline of the American empire, the people rushing to get away from it. But where they rush to and how they rush to it and what comes from that, can that be done in a way that doesn't make conflict inevitable in a sense in the future where you do have had nuclear proliferation, you do have it's as simple as it sounds, the U.S. and Israel against everybody, you have a powerful Russia and China, and then you're talking about the world war. All these things, are swirling around us right now. And I have to come back to this idea that we all should take a moment and realize this time in history and what we are gazing into in terms of the potentiality for what might come. And it's some pretty, pretty scary, heady stuff.
Do we have any insight, Matt, from the Biden administration and the way that they're communicating with the Netanyahu administration right now? We know that the United States is not willing to have any sort of conflict, major conflict with Iran. Iran as well, they don't want to have any sort of fight with the United States. But Netanyahu, he wants everything in the Middle East. But how the Biden administration is going to give the message to the Netanyahu administration that there has to be some sort of limits for what you're doing?
This point, Nima, is so important. I think that you're bringing up the political aspect of this. I can't imagine a worse time politically for this to be occurring to. So put this into Netanyahu's bag of tricks. The sense that you have a lame duck American president, a debilitated president who is being hidden from view. You have a general election campaign where what's going to come down to it is the two major candidates essentially trying to posture themselves to remain within the best graces of the Israel lobby that they can. Kamala Harris will make comments about peace and diplomacy and negotiations and two-state solution. And we all know that's nonsense. We all know that that's completely meaningless. That's just what her speechwriters are putting in there because that's good political speech making. Other than that, us, the Israelis, everyone who understands it knows that that's what we're seeing here. We're going to see a race between two people who are going to try and not just stay within the favors of the Israel lobby, but exploit them. And so looking at that, what type of American response would you expect? You have an America, you have the United States that at this point politically couldn't do anything other than go along with Israel. Of course it could. I mean, if you had real honest people, if you wouldn't have a political system that was essentially legalized bribery, maybe you'd have some other choices. But the reality of the American political system right now is so weak, it's so corrupted, it's so anemic that what else would you expect than to see the United States go along with Israel as needed. So I think the United States is going to be very hesitant in, say, dropping bombs on Hezbollah's positions in Lebanon, launching strikes into Iran, and they don't want this war. One, for the practical reasons that the United States is just simply overwhelmed, overextended. We don't have enough ships. We don't have enough munitions. We don't have enough men and women to crew the ships and fire their munitions. You know, I mean, the fact that we have one aircraft carrier on station there right now, one heading the way, the Abraham Lincoln, to relieve the Teddy Roosevelt. And my understanding is that Roosevelt's not staying on station, that she's going back home because she has to go back home to get repairs and maintenance and refit and rest and everything else. So you have 11 carrier battle groups within the American Navy. Only one is going to be able to be on station in the Middle East for this crisis. I mean, when it came time for the Iraq war, we had three or four on station, plus a ton of fixed of ground launched aircraft. I mean, the entire U.S. Air Force went over there. I mean, so you have this weakness, this emptiness in the American military that the Pentagon is well aware of. And so that's why you see this hesitation. Also, the White House understands that this war could go disastrously. It's not what we need politically. This is what, you know, I mean, there's all types of reasons, but in the politics of what's available, what can be done, I just don't think between this general election and this lame duck president that anything other than support for Israel will come forward. And the United States at that point will just be doing everything it can not to be fully involved in the sense of, again, launching airstrikes into Iran or launching airstrikes into Lebanon. We'll launch airstrikes into Yemen because, you know, our news here doesn't cover that. You know, they're seen as honest to God in the United States. The Yemenis are viewed as a lower class of human beings. I don't know how else to describe it. It doesn't matter what happens there. But Lebanon and Iran, we'll pay attention to. We are in a really bad situation here. Like I said, I can't imagine, I can't think of in the last however many decades, circumstances similarly politically that are in Netanyahu's favor for getting this war that he seems to want.
Yeah. After 9 months, more than 9 months of the conflict in Gaza, Matt, we had a major development by Chinese in by bringing all these groups, Palestinian groups, together and going after some sort of two-state solution. They were talking about an event on that. And right now, Israelis have assassinated the political and military leaders of Hamas. It seems that they're doing everything to destroy all those agreements that Chinese were trying to do.
Right. You can't, you know, and those things happen within a week of each other. You can't juxtapose two actions greater than that. You know, the Chinese unite a famously fractured Palestinian political groups. I think there's 15 or 16, I forget. But they get them all there. They get them all. I mean, so, and who knows what actually would come of that, right? But the fact that it was done, the fact that you have this step that was taken to get them to be at the table and to be in unity in that sense, that's massive. That's, you don't know what happened behind, you know, how much, you know, in Gaza, we know that the way it works is Hamas has the lead role in terms of international relations. So, say, Palestinian Islamic Jihad follows Hamas's lead when it comes to the international negotiations. So Hamas speaks for Gaza when they're at the table negotiating. Did the same thing come out now out of China with this type of unity? You know, are you going to have that level of cohesion and working together? I don't know, but that's the potential that could be there, right? Certainly more potential for it now than there was 2 weeks ago. And then Israel's response was to assassinate the Palestinian chief negotiator, Hamas's chief negotiator, Ismail Haniyeh. And, you know, I mean, this idea that, you know, this is how you deal with your negotiating partner is to blow the guy up. I mean, there's nothing that could be done to demonstrate greater commitment for war and greater opposition for peace and negotiations and an eventual political settlement than to kill your enemies, your adversaries, the negotiator. I mean, we've all seen movies, you know, where the negotiator is sent and his head gets returned in a basket to whoever sent them. I mean, that's essentially what occurred here. So the timing of it, of course, along with the assassination of Lebanon's of Hezbollah's man Fuad Shakir, the Netanyahu being in Washington D.C. You know, all of this comes together, and you know you can't think it's coincidental. Maybe it was, but in terms of the individual acts were coincidental, but certainly the circumstances that were assembled, the foundation upon which those individual acts stood, that was all done deliberately. So. Yeah, here we are again with this idea of like, this is the side that, well, you're in Brazil, so you don't have to take responsibility for it the way that we in the United States do. This is the side my country is on. My country is on the side that assassinates negotiators. Meanwhile, looking at the great opponent of the United States, the country that many in Washington, D.C. really want to go to war with, China, oh, they're actually out there practicing diplomacy. Meanwhile, my country is coddling murderers and thugs and assassins.
Matt, do you understand right now in the Middle East, what would be the end game for the United States? Because this forever conflict would not work for the United States, as you've mentioned, militarily and politically, because they need to have some sort of leverage in the Middle East. And the way that things are going, it doesn't seem to be to go in that direction.
No, I mean, certainly there's some strategy with the United States, and there's certainly things that are done in line with the strategy. So take last week, the United States announced that it was opening up a combatant headquarters in Japan. So previously in Japan, you had U.S. forces in Japan, and they were just really administrative. They just kind of processed paperwork, essentially, unlike, say, U.S. forces Korea, which was actually a warfighting command where there was a general and staff. And if war broke out, those would be the men and women in charge of actually fighting that war. Well, they've just done the same in Japan. They've converted Japan to a warfighting command. And so that's in line with American strategy in Asia, that you could see, okay, we're preparing for a war with China. One of the things we need to do is have these regional combatant commands that could hold things down for us in a command and control manner in certain areas. So you could see that there's some method to the madness, right? Fighting China is an insane, stupid, ridiculous idea, but at least there's a little bit of thought in there. But most of the time, what you're seeing with the Americans is a chasing of validation of the narrative. So what is our narrative about the Middle East? What is our narrative about Russia? What is our narrative about China? Okay, well, what can we say today that is going to support that already existing narrative? So you have in the United States this cycle of where domestic politics dominates everything. I think this is the case throughout the world, but particularly in the United States, our foreign policy is based so much upon domestic politics. All that is held within the confines of what used to be called the 24-hour news cycle. That's blown apart, right? So it's maybe 24-minute news cycle, maybe top of the hour news cycle, whatever it may be. So that need to always have political points that reinforce and support and validate what our narrative is. So then you have policy then that is created to support the narrative. This is something we talked about plenty of times before, Nima, right? This idea, we see John Kirby at the National Security Council, Matt Miller at the State Department, these spokespeople who, when they're off the podium, when they finish their press conference, it's not like they're included in the policy-making decisions. They are key members of the policy-making units. So when John Kirby leaves that podium, he goes, you know, to meetings where policy at the White House level is being made, and he is a prime driver of that. And so much of it is about reinforcing, supporting, validating the already existing political narrative that is confined to an almost instantaneous news cycle, right? So what you have is you have no policies, no plans being made or drawn up that are long-term looking, forward-looking. The best you get out of this is the best that you get in sense of like where they actually put something down and then went out and did it was the pier off of Gaza. This is a great example of this, where the priority was not to relieve the suffering in Gaza. The priority was not to stop the starvation. The priority was not to stop Israel's genocide. The priority was to make our policy look good. How do we make our policy look good? Well, make us look like we're actually out there delivering aid. That'd be great. We'll get great shots out of it. It also, too, it distracts from what's actually occurring there. And it takes the pressure off of Israel, because we all know the real problem, the starvation, is driven by Israel's closure of the land entrances. So if we have this pier coming in, everyone's looking at the ocean, and we're driving the aid off of the pier, and everyone forgets about the fact that all these thousands and thousands of trucks are being held up at the border points, at the crossing points by Israel. I mean, you know, and that's what, so even something that's like a 2 or 3 month long, catastrophe like that pier project was, you see how really what it's meant to do is support the daily political narrative that exists, that is put out there to support the overall sustaining political narrative. It's sickening. It's gross to watch, but that's how the American situation works. You're going to have big events like, say, the American invasion of Iraq or things like that, that really change things and mix things up. But for the most part, I think with American foreign policy, its purpose is to politically support the domestic poly narratives that are in existence.
Do you think that the conflict in the Middle East is just distracting the United States from what's going on in Ukraine, or the United States just focused on Ukraine as well by sending F-16s?
Well, I think, you know, we said this while back, right? You know, like for the Ukrainians, they have to be prepared to become the next Afghans. And we saw that happen very clearly in October, where, you know, for at that point, October of 23, a year and three quarters or so into the war, everybody in the world is familiar with it, with how important artillery is in that war in Ukraine, how short Ukraine is with artillery rounds. October 7th comes around, and artillery rounds that were in Poland or Germany, destined to go to Ukraine, were boxed back up, put on a plane, and sent to Israel. Right. So right away, you had this clear indication of like Ukraine get in the backseat, you know, there's a commitment to Ukraine among the American establishment, but it certainly is a commitment that falls below Israel. And as part of a subordinate belief in fighting Russia, of the need to have Russia as this great enemy of the United States. Well, that's a distant second in Washington, D.C. to having China as that great enemy. I mean, don't get me wrong. There's plenty of we have seen the last 10 years of Russiagate, the Russia phobia, the hysteria, all of that. It's all very real. But that has always been subordinate to, I think, this understanding in Washington, D.C. that our real enemy, our real challenge, the real war will have to be against Russia. And even when you look at some of the folks out there who argue that we should not be antagonistic with Russia, that we should have had a policy where we sought to cooperate and work with and be friends with Russia, a lot of times that argument comes back to this idea of, because we will need them against China, right? Because, you know, or that we shouldn't have been so hard on Russia. We shouldn't be so antagonistic and adversarial with Russia because we have pushed them to China, and really we should be putting a wedge because we're going to need them to at least be neutral when we fight China. So much of this keeps coming back to China. It's something we've heard of for decades in the United States. I mean, people have to remember that when the George W. Bush administration comes into office, in 2001, January 2001, their focus is China. That's all that Susan Rice, National Security Advisor at the time, wants to talk about is China. I mean, that was 23 years ago. I mean, so this has been something that, you know, since the end of the Cold War, China has been the focus of American policymakers, of the crackpot realists, the fantasists, the fabulists that populate Washington, D.C. China has been their dream. So we have to remember that, as we try and understand why Washington, D.C. makes the decisions it makes.
Matt, whenever we were talking about Ukraine, we were talking about how Washington and neocons are forcing Europeans to help Ukraine. Right now, it seems that with the new changes in the European Union, you cannot recognize who's Europe, who's Washington. Mm-hmm. They're just the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sorry. In the last question, you asked me something about the F-16s and I started just ranting about China. So if you want to remind me about that.
Yeah, go after F-16s. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So with the F-16s, I guess they showed up. It seems like they showed up. We saw some video. We have no, of course, idea where, of course, that video was shot from. There's questions out there about where they're actually going to base these F-16s. We know the Russians already have bounties on the F-16s. There's only supposedly six of them. Maybe six pilots. They've walked back repeatedly in the American press now the importance of the F-16s. The Washington Post a week or so ago saying, you know, very clearly, these are not game changers. They're going to have a limited role. In the role that, when you put it sensibly and without the rhetoric, without the lunacy that surrounds the cheerleading for this war, it makes sense to have them as another component of your air defense system, an air defense system that is crumbling and in bad need of assistance in, you know, Ukraine's air defense system. So, of course, even getting a couple of F-16s, you get them up in the air with some air-to-air missiles and able to knock down some drones or whatever, you know, that's great. But the way it was built up, and now that they got them, the reality has caught up with the narrative, right? So what's the next thing going to be? So we know that the F-16s aren't going to do what they were promised to do. They're not going to win the war, you know. But this was the bridge to the next best thing after, I think, particularly last year's counteroffensive. So, or I shouldn't say counteroffensive because it's just offensive. So Ukraine's 2023 summer offensive, spectacular failure, just threw tens of thousands of Ukrainian men into a meat grinder, exhausted Ukrainian material and resources in the way that just absolutely criminally negligent. They needed a bridge in the narrative. And these F-16s, I think, were that bridge. You also had the drama as well with Republicans in the American Congress holding off the money. So that was another piece of the narrative, because now you're setting up a villain. You're setting up a stab in the back. We could have won the war in Ukraine, but the Republicans stabbed us in the back. If we had had that $60 billion in Ukrainian hands, you know, back in the fall of 2023, this would have been a different war. I mean, all these, right? I mean, all this narrative, all this messaging, this propaganda, whatever you want to call it. Now that the F-16s have shown up, because the F-16s were held back for too long, they should have started doing this earlier, blah, 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 blah. Now what's the next thing? What's the next thing on the narrative list, right? So I think it's going to be ramping up for a spring 25 offensive. That's the next thing that is going to be in the Western press. But the unity that you were alluding to in that other question, Nima, about how essentially there is no daylight, if you will, between the Europeans and Americans on this, I think is something that should be very troubling for Europeans. The fact that so many of their governments are in lockstep with the Americans on Ukraine, with the British on Ukraine, based upon the spectacular disasters and failures and immoral tragedies of Western foreign policy, of the American Empire's conduct over the decades, that they are lined up with this. Well, that spells you know, a self-inflicted wound that's coming. That could be catastrophic. And that's not being, again, I won't be exaggerative here. The United States views Europe as its buffer zone. And I don't know if the Europeans really get that. Like, you see how aggressive the Estonia, I understand the Balts, the Baltics and the Finland and Poland's animus with Russia. It's a long history. I understand all that. But do they understand that those are precisely the nations, the Baltics, Finland, Poland, are precisely the nations, along with, I guess, maybe Romania on the Black Sea, that are the buffer zone for the Americans? We think we can escalate up to a point where Helsinki is lost, where Warsaw is lost, maybe even potentially a German city is lost. So when we go and we put Tomahawk cruise missiles with nuclear capacity into Germany next year, our estimation is that, well, what would happen if they ever actually got used is that it would all occur in Europe and we'd have ability to de-escalate before it extended to the United States. Now, of course, the Russians are immediately cutting the legs off of that by saying we're going to put our weapon systems in places that will reach the United States. I'm not certain where. I can't imagine the Cubans want to go through that again. Maybe they do. I don't know. But the idea, though, that the United States views Europe as its buffer zone is something I really don't think the Europeans get. And so this obsequiousness, this unity, this no daylight with the Americans on things like this is incredibly dangerous. And, you know, again, we'll say, I've probably said it 20 times now on your program, you know, Henry Kissinger, right? It's dangerous to be America's enemy, deadly to be its allies.
Yeah. And the other thing, Matt, right now is the situation in the United Kingdom. I don't know if you saw the news coming out of the United Kingdom. These riots are going on and on. And what's going on in your opinion? What's happening there? Is that related to what's going on in the Middle East?
Yeah, absolutely it is, in a sense that where are the refugees coming from? And certainly I'm not supportive in the riots in any way, shape, or form. But I also am a believer and follower and adherent to Dr. Martin Luther King. And he believed, you know, he taught us that the riots are the voice of the unheard. And so while there's a lot of disgusting things about those riots in the UK, and please don't anyone get me wrong in the sense that I'm supportive of it, there is a voice there of being unheard. And you have poverty, you have issues in England, you have a decaying healthcare system, you have all kinds of things where things for many people in the United Kingdom have gotten worse, not just measurably be a statistic wise, but like people will tell you anecdotally their stories, and you could make huge, huge books and volumes with those stories. And of course, that type of decay, that decline in society, people look for scapegoats. Some people look for those scapegoats because it's a way to explain what's happening to them. Others, particularly say far right politicians, use it because it's an opportunity. And so I think that's what you're seeing here, this idea that the decline in Britain, who are we going to blame it on? And for some way, we have the same thing here in the United States. The United States is for its whole existence has always blamed things on immigrants, even though immigrants are those who built this country. We couldn't sustain our economy right now without our immigrant base, without the millions who come into our country. We couldn't. And the idea of blaming those people, people, migrants, immigrants, refugees, for the consequences of decisions of people made at the top. So the decisions made by those in power, somehow they're able to blame it on the migrants, the refugees, the immigrants. All right. This idea that it was an immigrant who took your job rather than some boss somewhere who decided that I can fire these white people and hire these brown people for less. And it was a decision made by the boss, not by the immigrant, but somehow that's the way it's able to be played. So why are these immigrants showing up? Why are these refugees showing up? To get to your point, it's because of the wars in the Middle East. Where are they coming from? They're coming from Libya. They're coming from Syria. The Afghans, those poor people have been the biggest refugee population in the world for, 50 years now, or 45 years or however long. And so it just the idea that somehow these people just, the Democratic presidential contender, our vice president, people make fun of her, but I kind of like it. She says, what do you think? You fell out of a coconut tree? Like, what do you think? These immigrants fell out of a coconut tree? That's how they got there? There's reasons why they showed up. And those reasons are because their countries have been devastated by wars that, for the most part, are the result of American imperial policy and nations of Western Europe going along with it.
Yeah. Before wrapping up, Matt, there was a presidential election in Venezuela in which Elon Musk, he was trying to help opposition there. Do you understand what's in it for Elon Musk personally, or even he's affiliated, he's connected with any sort of political parties? That's why he's trying to do that and interfering in a foreign community, a foreign country, Venezuela, that people are suffering. We know that people are suffering in Venezuela under tremendous sanctions for a long time. In many years, they've been sanctioned by the United States. But how do you see the situation right now and in Venezuela?
Yeah, I think he's, I don't know. I mean, I shouldn't comment directly on Musk's commentary with regards to the present situation in Venezuela. I saw something that he and Maduro agreed to a fist fight or something like that. But my money would be on Maduro, by the way. But overall, Musk has said things about South America going back years now. That makes sense in the understanding of what he needs for his empire as the world's largest, world's wealthiest man, and where his empire, his own personal, has been built upon. So much of it requires like those rare earth minerals that we hear so much about. So when there's that coup in Bolivia 2-3 years ago, 4 years ago, whenever that was, Musk tweets out, "We'll coup whoever we want," and so I think I don't know how much of is directly tied into Venezuela right now. Venezuela, certainly world's largest reserves of oil. We all know that. I don't know what Venezuela's position is with regards to the rare earth minerals, but any of that, anything that falls into resources, Musk in his role, in his being, in his way of life is going to see that as his. This is what he's entitled to. He is an apparatus, an appendage of the American empire. So his own personal empire falls underneath that. It's one of the, he's one of the cogs in the system of the American empire, very large cog, very public, visible cog, but a cog. And, you know, but to keep that going, he understands that the United States needs to dominate places like South Africa. South America. I'm sure he said the same about Africa, right? So I think it's just in line with his general view that this is what should be. I think it also is, posturing in the sense that he has he's donating a lot to Donald Trump's campaign. There was no secret that the Trump administration, its views on Venezuela, they had a coup plan in place, as well as all those heavy sanctions they put on. So it could also be too, just to curry favor, or just not, maybe not even, I don't want to put it like that, curry favor, just because he's part of that crowd and he believes this is the right thing to do. We should dominate, we should control it, and we should get rid of Maduro. And that's in line with his other messaging on South America.
Yeah, the problem is, Matt, they're just saying that they don't recognize Maduro as the president of the, they're just picking someone else, his opponent. This guy is the president. It seems that in the United States, it's for the United States to decide who's going to be the president of Venezuela.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's also transparent too, right? It's sickening how transparent the whole thing is, where see so clearly why the United States is interested, why we've been involved. You can't have a better juxtaposition of our policy than Venezuela's neighbor, Colombia, where the United States for decades provided just a ton of military support to a narcotics regime. I mean, the drug kingdom. I mean, that's what Colombia was, as well as then our more covert actions there in terms of what our CIA was doing with the drug lords themselves, as well as the anti-communist guerrillas. You just had that judicial ruling against United Fruit, essentially, because United Fruit was funding those death squads for years in order to protect their interests down in South America. And when you start to pull it apart and see how just corrupt and wicked this whole thing is, well, who is one of the people that was one of United Fruit's main lawyers years ago in terms of defending them from this lawsuit, that the fact that they have been financing death squads? Well, it was Eric Holder, Barack Obama's attorney general. You mean, like, so the corruption on this, it's also intertwined. It's also apparent. And it's so sickening because it is so clear what this is about. It's about the oil, you know, because otherwise, we could treat it like Colombia, or we treat Colombia like Venezuela, or vice versa, right? However you want to, line that up. So it really is. It's disgusting and sickening. And the poor people of Venezuela, like other places, this, unfortunately, this might be the best situation for Venezuela going forward right now. Like, things may only get worse for the Venezuelans going forward. It's likely, I think, that things will get worse, whether in terms of more sanctions or coup or some type of civil war or whatever.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Matt, for being with us today. Great pleasure as always.
Yeah. Thank you, Nima.
See you soon, Matt.
All right. Bye-bye.